I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Whole Wide World, testing rationales for war in a single superpower planet. We've been taking a sort of museum tour of war theories. Here's a very personal take on the real thing on the ground in northern Iraq.
I don't view it as a war of colonization war. It's a war of liberation. That's the word we use here. And no, there's not an Iraqi around here. There's not a Kurd in existence. There's no way I can walk here for the next 50 miles in either direction. You ask everybody, what's this American war all about? They'll tell you it's a war of liberation.
Here's the question. What if it is noble idealism that justifies war? Not oil, not empire, not the cruel friction of cultures, that clash of civilizations. Kenan Makiya is one of those true believers in exporting modern democracy to his fellow Iraqis with force as need be. He's an architect, a writer, a 60s rebel grown up. His scathing book titled The Republic of Fear exposed Saddam's system before the 1990 invasion of Kuwait, before it was fashionable to be anti-Saddam or pro the Kurdish minority. In the past year, Kenan Makiya has taken up with Donald Rumsfeld, Condoleezza Rice, and the war on Saddam idea. His long-shot bet is that the U.S. can break all its bad old habits of putting oil and stability over democracy, favoring Turkey at the Kurds' expense. We got him by phone the other day under the snow-capped mountains of Salahuddin in northern Iraq. He was talking brave and bracing at the same time for betrayal by the Bush administration.
Well, Chris, let me put it this way. I think this could be a war about democracy in the Middle East. I say it could be. I don't know that it is going to be that, but it could be. That's what I stand for. That's what I'm fighting for. That's why I'm here.
How would it go?
If it were a war about democracy in the Middle East, then it would have to begin with, it would have to be based on certain premises. Number one, the United States would be going in there not only to change the Saddam regime and search for weapons of mass destruction, but actually dismantle the repressive institutions of the Ba'ath Party, undergo a de-Ba'athification program in Iraq, sort of like the denazification program in Germany, and work with, as a partner with, in partnership with, a provisional government formed out of the meeting of the Iraqi opposition, which is currently taking place.
He will feel damned if he sees Tommy Franks or any other American general setting up a military government for Iraq. Kenan Makiya wants to see Iraqi oppositionists in power the very day after liberation. For the Kurds, he's also demanding federalism in Iraq, modeled on our states within the American Union. The Bush team, on the contrary, is ready to usher in Turkish police to keep a lid on the Kurds. Kenan Makiya, you're out there on the line in Iraq for a democratic revolution, but you've got grave doubts that that's really what the Bush administration is invested in. What's the gap here?
There is, I believe, a real struggle going on inside the Bush administration. There is the forces of the past. I mean, American foreign policy has been about nothing if not support of dictators and god-awful regimes and replacing democracies with dictatorships and so on throughout the world, by and large. After September 11th, that policy began to be questioned inside the Bush administration. I'm convinced that that is the case. Now, there are forces that, of course, naturally bureaucracies and so on, that have individuals who have whole careers invested in the previous policy. These are the people that do not want to see democracy in Iraq. These are the people with the connections to the autocratic regimes of the Arab world. These are the people who were formerly ambassadors and fellow travelers who want to appease the Arab countries, who are interested in accommodation and keeping the existing status quo.
Would you call this a fight for the mind of President Bush?
Yes. Absolutely. For the heart and soul of America also, if I might put it that way. That is the United States going to work in its foreign policy to the values it holds internally to itself, close to its own heart, that is inside America, or is it going to be about the crassest form of self-interest and supporting dictatorships and so on? Is it the case that the values upon which the United States was built are universal values that belong to other people's cultures, or are they strictly American values in American eyes themselves? That's what this is really about in the end.
Kenan, the argument is all over this country too. Is this a war for oil, for empire, for liberation, for democracy? How will we know on the evidence from Iraq that you have won or lost your fight for a real democratization?
Well, it's going to take a number of years before that question is settled.
Can we use the Kurds in a certain way as a litmus of the integrity and the good faith of this war operation by the Bush administration?
Well, that's a very good question, Chris, because the counterpart to this military government idea is the sending in of Turkish troops, would you believe it, into northern Iraq. So here you had an opportunity when people of Iraq would welcome with sweets and flowers, as I told the president when I met him on January 10th, you know, where an army would be viewed as liberated, suddenly sending in the most hated enemies of the Kurds imaginable. Kurds are terrified of that. So you have the beginning of a feeling of betrayal amongst the Kurds in this case. That is, I hope, it's not going to be a dress rehearsal for what might happen in the whole of Iraq if this military government idea excluding Iraqis proceeds.
Kanan, we've got such mixed feelings about this war, but we have nothing but faith in you. So take good care
That's
of yourself.
So kind of you, Chris.
And all the best.
I know that man well. He is no cynic and no sellout for war either. You hear war's exhilaration in Kanan Makiya's breathlessness and war's dread. Real lives are at risk now in a war to validate his dreams. You also ask yourself, how often really does war make dreams come true? Chalmers Johnson has a colder, cautionary eye on another big picture entirely. Beware the pawns of empire, he says, including those true believers and American dreamers.
We teach that usually no empire ever dismantled itself, ever reversed its course. It simply proceeds on to its own miserable end.
Chalmers Johnson of Berkeley and UC San Diego is a lifelong student of Asian politics who had an epiphany on a formal visit to Okinawa in the mid-1990s. What he saw in the far Pacific was an American outpost of something very like the late Soviet Empire.
I was shocked to see the obvious signs of the American Raj, of the fact that there was no strategy behind these deployments. There was simply the Marines had been there since 1945, and they were extremely comfortable playing golf and enjoying apartments and a quality of life that would be much better than they could have if they were located, say, in Oceanside, California, next door to Camp Pendleton. They reminded me of the Soviet troops in East Germany who did not want to go home after the wall came down because they lived so comfortably in East Germany. I took up the study of Okinawa. I guess the thing that then began to dawn on me is that I thought Okinawa was unique. I now realize that, no, it's typical of the 700 American military bases located in other people's countries.
With empire, Johnson says, comes what the CIA used to call blowback, the unintended consequences of U.S. meddling in the world. With boldness to match Sam Huntington's, Chalmers Johnson wrote a book titled Blowback a year before 9/11. It foresaw imperial chickens coming home to roost with a vengeance.
This book was written quite explicitly as a warning to my fellow citizens that the trend of events since the end of the Cold War was leading toward very strong possibilities of major retaliation against the United States.
What is it that's coming back to haunt us in the case of 9/11?
Precisely our actions that began actually back in 1953 with the overthrow of the elected government of Iran for the sake of the British Petroleum Company and the installation of the Shah of Iran, who led to an extremely repressive and government that sacrificed the human rights of very intelligent people.
How does that get you to 9/11, Osama bin Laden?
I'm explaining that. You asked me, what was my immediate reaction on 9/11? My first reaction was not that it came from the Middle East.
Really?
I thought of any numbers of places it might have come from, including Southeast Asia, from Indonesia. I regarded among the most tragic sights I had ever seen in watching television in the days after 9/11 was a sight of young American women standing in lower Manhattan holding up photographs of their husbands, sons,
yes,
daughters, etc., And I stared at these pictures and I said, that really is bringing it home to the Americans. But as I stared at these pictures, it finally dawned on me, I've seen these pictures before. These are a term invented in Spanish. It's not standard Spanish. Los desaparecidos, the disappeared, that women in Buenos Aires, in Santiago, held up under the regimes of General Pinochet and others because they knew what had happened to their loved ones. They had been carried off by military regimes, installed and supported by the United States government, and they were tortured and executed. They disappeared. And I thought, well, it could have been an Argentine. It could have been a group of Argentines. It could have been a group of Chileans with perfectly good justice. It could have been any number of people from Central America where the Reagan administration in the 1980s delivered to those small countries, particularly El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and Nicaragua, the worst decade since the Spanish conquest. If I were a Guatemalan, I might well have thought of getting even with the gringos. It did turn out that it was Muslims this time, when in my view, it could have been any number of different groups that caused 9/11, and that we have every reason to expect they do, that this will continue until we acknowledge what happened in the past and begin to alter our policies accordingly.
To Chalmers Johnson's mind, what 9/11 recalls is a turning point in the history of the British Empire in India. In the Sepoy Mutiny of 1857, Indian troops, known as Sepoys, rebelled against their English masters and took back the capital city of Delhi for a while.
The Indians do not call the Sepoy Mutiny the Sepoy Mutiny. They call it the first war, the first battle of the War of Independence that ended a century later. That strikes me as something like a clash of civilizations, and that if you want to use it in that sense, that may well be what happened on 9/11, in that the people who attacked the World Trade Center and the Pentagon were our sepoys. They were people we had trained for our military purposes, armed, paid no real attention to what they thought, we're not even sure that we could imagine that they did think. But it turns out they did think, they observed us a lot more closely than we observed them, and they discovered that they had signed up with some very unscrupulous people, and they got even with us.
In the aftermath, there seems to be a lot more itching to get even everywhere.
War now, in the period after the Cold War, seems much more likely. We have lost the constraint that the existence of the Soviet Union imposed upon us toward at least elementary prudence. We have begun to become hubristic and to talk about odd and inflated terms like civilization and clash of civilizations, and to denigrate the cultures of other people when it is almost impossible to imagine that one culture is superior to another. I mean, that's one of the things that is bedeviling the Bush administration. It loves cliches about evil people or other such things, which are instantaneously used by Putin over the Chechens, or by the Indians and the Pakistanis who've hated each other for a very long time, and both have nuclear weapons, used by Ariel Sharon to now say that he is the world's greatest student of George Bush and he is punishing terrorists who are evildoers. These kinds of things lead on toward anarchy and chaos. That is why I would say it is no time to envy the young. Those of us who are getting closer to the end of our lives must look back on a period of peace. It would be wise to try and avoid these wars, but talking about clashes of civilization is assuredly one of the worst possible ways to do it.
Chalmers Johnson rejects the Huntington clash of civilizations as a rallying cry for war and armaments. He also discounts the dread that Huntington and the Bush team seem to share of a coming contest with China for hegemony in East Asia.
Why on earth should a rich and comfortable China with high levels of living and pride in their country, why should that be to the disadvantage of either the United States or Japan? That is to say, the Chinese are undoubtedly going to have enormous influence in East Asia and are going to ask, what are we continuing to do there, particularly if we can't do anything more than place Marines in various bases around the place or air bases with B-2 bombers. Under these circumstances, it's up to the United States to change or face the consequences.
So Chalmers Johnson's bumper sticker is Empire, Heal Thyself, with the footnote that very few empires do. But what if war lust runs deeper than imperialism? When we come back, Chris Hedges of the New York Times talks about what he learned at too many wars and a parting poem from Seamus Heaney. You're listening to The Whole Wide World from PRI, Public Radio International.